This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
So this is Laura interviewing Joe Callingham for the Jodcast. Joe is an astronomer, a postdoc researcher at Astron at the moment. So Joe, how's it going? How have you been liking Manchester so far?
Oh, it's been enjoyable so far. It's kind of funny as an Australian to be back in the UK. It's like a shade of my own country.
Well, the Netherlands is nice too, right? But Manchester is better.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. It's definitely lovely to be here.
So what are you working on at the moment?
So I'm a reasonably random, I think, researcher at the moment. So I did my PhD on how radio galaxies evolve and change. And lately, my fellowship at Astron, I've been focusing pretty much on stars a lot more. So particularly, I've been focusing on what's called a colliding wind binary. These are two massive stars orbiting each other, and their winds are so fast and so full of mass that when they collide, they emit in X-rays and radio, so they get to super millions of degrees Celsius at the shock front. And otherwise, I've just been looking at boring old stars also in the radio. But I don't know, I don't think they're that boring.
Well, yeah, I mean, when I was told that I was looking at stars, I was like, oh, come on, stars. As a pulsar person, you go, yeah. Stars.
I think everyone does that. I reckon it's untapped potential. You know, stars at radio frequencies, hot new field.
Yep, exactly. Watch out. It's coming.
It's coming for you.
So these colliding wind binaries, what are you looking in both X-rays and radio at them? And what do you sort of find out?
So that's an interesting question. So they're one of those few objects that pretty much emit across the electromagnetic spectrum, actually. They're probably the faintest in optical light, like light we see with our eyes. But you're really, really focusing on the shock. When these two winds that are traveling at, say, millions of kilometers an hour, you know, like 3,500 kilometers a second, when they collide, they really get quite hot and emit at X-rays. And because you've got magnetic fields, you get synchrotron emission as well. So you see it in the radio. They're interesting. They give us insights into how massive stars die, all kinds of fun stuff like that.
So they have to be massive stars? And are they really close together?
So they have to be massive stars, usually. Mm-hmm. So you have a few types of stars that are known to be in colliding wind binaries. So these O-type stars, they're about as much as 20 times the mass of our sun. If you get two of those together, you can get it. But the ones that probably make the most spectacular colliding wind binaries, you know, the kind of top of the mountain in terms of craziness and just emission characteristics, are Wolf-Rayet stars. Mm-hmm. These are stars that were massive stars, just like those O-type stars, but they're more evolved versions. These are stars they consider being near the end of their lives, you know, they're in the last few percent, and they're just losing mass quite rapidly. They're quite unstable. And so, yeah, so my colleagues, Peter Tuttle in Sydney and Ben Pope in New York, and myself, obviously, we found a really interesting one that kind of confounded our expectations and was very pretty.
So how rare are these things then? Because I can imagine when we normally have two stars evolving together, often one evolves way faster and then goes supernova and ends up with a black hole or a pulsar or something like that. That's kind of our, I guess, our stereotypical idea of binary evolution. You have two different mass stars or even similar mass stars, but on different timescales. Mm-hmm. So how rare is it to end up with two massive stars, both at this wind stage?
It's a very good question and something that I've been annoying a lot of the theorists about. So funnily enough, often massive stars almost always occur in binary pairs, you know, so often they appear together. And I'm not enough expert to tell you exactly the reasoning behind that, but like 70, I think it's something like ridiculous, like 70% of all massive stars are actually in a binary. And then, so evolution isn't that ridiculous when you think about it in terms of like, if they're very similar masses, they can actually go to similar evolutionary stages. Not saying that's guaranteed. So how many would, so this system we found, we hypothesized likely it's actually two Wolf-Rayet stars next to each other. Mm-hmm. And as opposed to some of these other colliding wind binaries, it's maybe two O-type stars, which makes a lot of sense to find a lot more of those, because a star lives its life in an O-star type for a lot longer than a Wolf-Rayet phase. Mm-hmm. So what's the possibility of getting two Wolf-Rayets together is a question I don't think we quite know the answer to. And there's a couple of, this is not the first one. There's at least one other known for listeners that are interested. Wolf-Rayet 48A is also known as a double Wolf-Rayet. So yeah, now we're starting to get a few of these. As the question is for the theorists and the evolutionary modelers, is like, is this expected? You know, I don't know the answer to that.
So are you trying to look for more? What telescope are you using? Are you using like really low frequency radio or mid-range?
So it was super odd. This emerged from... So I'm very lucky in my position at Astron, and I only can thank them enough, is that I've given a lot of freedom, you know. So obviously my PhD was on this galaxy evolution stuff, but right at the end of my thesis, I was kind of pottering around and found something that looked like a peak spectrum source. So... For people that are interested, I worked on things that essentially, if you looked at the flux with frequency, instead of just getting brighter at low frequencies, they actually started to fall over and decline, and that tells us stuff about how galaxies change. And I just had a dumb thought. It was like, I wonder how much of this, what these kind of sources look like, where they rise and fall. You know, they have this peak in their spectrum in the radio. I wonder what galactic sources show these kind of properties. And I had an interesting source long ago that was sitting in my back of my brain from my honors research when I was a young whippersnapper.
Mm-hmm.
I just checked it out and I was like, wow, this kind of correlates. And so I, with Peter and Ben, we followed it up with the Very Large Telescope in Chile. And we did infrared imaging and a whole bunch of other stuff that really showed us that this is a spectacular image that we made that in the dust. And it shows this very complicated kind of Archimedean spiral, kind of like the shells of the spiral of a shell. It was a phenomenal picture that we made, and it kind of confounded our understanding of how these colliding wind binary physics should really apply.
Okay, so then if it's got a sort of a peaked spectrum, then you probably can't look at it at the lowest frequency.
Yeah, so it's not there. So the weird thing is that it's about, I don't know how much details we want to go into, but it goes from essentially 300 millijanskies to nothing. 300 millijanskies at 300 megahertz to nothing at 150 megahertz. So that's a rapid decline. It's exponential. Essentially, it's gone from something that would be very standard to observe with any telescope at 300 megahertz. Like that brightness is very easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then for it to disappear in that small frequency range is quite odd. Even more odd than any galaxy.
Mm-hmm. So it just completely drops off.
Just disappears.
Nice. And do you have any other candidates for this sort of thing? Or is that just kind of, because you say you did it in your honours. For those of you who don't know, honours is like a fourth year undergraduate. So in the UK, that would be an MPhil. Yeah. But in Australia, it's an honours.
I'll trust your translation.
Yeah.
As an Australian.
Yeah, exactly.
Living in the UK.
He's lived overseas. you just sort of, I guess, happened across this object, like a lot of astronomy happens that way, where we just stumble across things. But are you looking for more, or anybody looking for more?
Yeah, definitely looking for more. So we just completed a survey of the galactic plane. So one of part of my thesis that I didn't fully explain was producing an all-sky survey with this new radio telescope in the Southern Hemisphere called the Murchison Wide Field Array. Now, this is a similar, listeners might have heard of the thing called LOFAR that's also in the Netherlands. This is kind of like the Southern Hemisphere version of this. It's not as expensive, so it hasn't got all the bells and whistles, but so it can't go as deep and it hasn't got as high resolution. But the big winner for the telescope is its spectral coverage. An observation with that telescope means you get instantaneous coverage from 72 megahertz to 230 megahertz. That's like right in the FM band, and so this has to be located in the middle of nowhere, Western Australia, you know, where there's like one big toe per square kilometer of people, you know. Anyway, if that gives a good vision for the listeners.
What is it? It's 100 people, but it's the size of the Netherlands?
Yeah, I think it's the size of the Netherlands. I can't remember these off the top of my head, but like middle of bloody nowhere Australia.
Yeah.
It's pretty much as isolated as you can get, which makes it really good for radio astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
So I helped produce an all-sky survey with that, and we're just about to release, with Natasha Hurley-Walker largely leading it and Paul Hancock, and we're producing the galactic plane at the moment. And so there's a whole bunch of these that turn over in the galactic plane. The question is, are they extragalactic? Are they galactic?
Mm-hmm.
I just haven't had the time at the moment to research it because obviously I've got other interests, as I was saying early on.
Yeah, so there's just a lot of future work to go for this one. It's not...
No, in terms of population studies, it is, but this is an oddball. These are this colliding wind binary that Peter and Ben and I discovered... is one of those outliers of a population that can kind of open a new way of thinking about a population.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it's just got accepted in Nature Astronomy, so it should be out soon. So it's, it's a really fun thing to work on. And to be honest, as I said, and I hope the listeners, by the time they hear this, can also look at the image or seen it in press releases or something, it is a lovely image. And this is one of the reasons I know, obviously, I'm a scientist, I want to send questions and answers, but I'm also an astronomer, and there's something to be said about making pretty pictures.
Yeah, it's always nice in radio astronomy. You often get some nice...
Well, like my PhD was looking at, is this line curved or straight was pretty much my PhD. So when I make a pretty image, it was like, this is what I became an astronomer for, right?
Nice. So you also said you were working on boring stars. Can you tell us about that, or is it top secret?
It's not too much top secret. So they're boring stars in the sense that they're just solar mass stars or less. And so again, I mentioned a colleague's name, Ben Pope. He was visiting me. And now at Astron, we're producing probably... well, the deepest all-sky survey that's ever been done. And so we're able to go so deep now that the question was, wonder what we can see. So when you turn on when you look at the night sky with your eyes, right, everything you see is stars, right, pretty much, with your naked eye. There's with a few exceptions in the Southern Hemisphere, which is a much more beautiful sky, by the way. You can see galaxies really easily, at least two. And you can kind of make out Andromeda with your eye, right?
If you're lucky.
If you squint.
Yeah, but we've got a lot of dust and stuff in the Southern Hemisphere as well that's blocking the light from the stars and the Milky Way. I mean, we are luckier in the Southern Hemisphere if you haven't been down.
Yeah, I recommend actually going down south and seeing the sky.
This is what happens when you've got two Aussies talking on the podcast. brag about how nice the sky is.
It is. It's much prettier. There's no doubt about it. It's actually objectively true.
Yeah.
Anyway, when you look in the night sky with your eyes, you see stars. You're dominated by stellar emission. Even when you see a galaxy, what you're seeing is stars. Mm-hmm. When you turn on if I could replace your eyes with a radio antenna, you're pretty much dominated by extragalactic emission, largely from, except obviously with the exception of the galactic plane, largely from material falling onto black holes. So if I just gave you a source randomly, Laura, and I said, here's a radio source, 99.9% of the time, you can say that is most likely a extragalactic source. That's that's a galaxy far away. You know, obviously, I know you study pulsars and all that kind of fun stuff, but still, how many pulsars are known?
3,000.
3,000. Yeah, this survey we just conducted is 300,000 in 400 square degrees of largely galaxies.
There's
loads more. So there's loads more. So like, I think 99.9% of all catalog radio sources are probably extragalactic.
Yeah.
So at least 99%. So the question became with this idea was that now we're going so deep, maybe we're hitting the tip of this iceberg where we can start see stars just like the optical guys see stars.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a fun little project that I thought would be, I don't know, why not have a little bit of a side project and an enjoyment. And this is where another astronomer called Harish, turned up at Astron, as a staff member. And, we kind of bounced a few ideas off each other and we went down this path of studying boring old stars. So the question is, what do they look like at these frequencies? They're very basic questions. I only work on basic things, you know, I'm not a in-depth, nitty-gritty kind of guy. I'm just like, what does this look like at these frequencies, you know? Does this make sense? And so, yeah, that's what I've been working on lately.
So how did you spot these things then? If you said that, you know, most of the time it's not a star, it's probably something elsewhere, then how do you find the things that
how you confident?
Yeah, how do you go, okay, that one, that's in our galaxy, or it's likely to be in our galaxy anyway, because, you know, we're astronomers, we know that not everything is 100% sure, but how would you be able to differentiate, say, that's not a quasar, you know, that's at a redshift of whatever, that's actually a star in our galaxy?
Yeah, that's really hard, because essentially, as I said, you know, if I gave you a radio source, you would say 99.9% that's going to be a extragalactic source by itself. So how do you assess the association with that in a star? And so essentially all I'm trying to do is convince you. The funny thing is back in the past, I know, I'm going to go on a history diatribe Let's just take a tangent here. The fun part was a long time ago when radio astronomy was first turning on, you know, when the experiments being done here in Jodrell and stuff at the University of Sydney and obviously in Cambridge as well, they had this problem where everyone thought these radio sources were stars, and they had to spend all this time showing the majority of these radio sources are actually extragalactic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 60, 70 years later, it's the reverse problem where I'm like, everyone's like, everything's extragalactic. I have to do this reverse problem of convincing people it's a star.
Yeah.
So the answer is a few things. So obviously, what you need is a cross match. So when I look in my optical catalogs and my radio catalogs, I need the position of the star and the radio source to line up, right? But that doesn't guarantee anything because there's lots of stars and there's lots of radio galaxies. And so the accuracy of how well you know the position of your radio source is quite poor relatively to the accuracy, the density of stars in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
So in terminology to stat speak, you tend to be dominated by false positives, right? If I just throw a billion stars at the sky and then I throw 300,000 radio sources with a largish error circle, the chances of them just by chance aligning up is quite high.
Yeah.
So you can't just do it on that. So the next thing you do is the type of emission characteristics you expect from a star. And so stars are known to be variable emission. So from particularly stars like M dwarfs, which are much smaller than our sun, these are kind of red stars. They tend to show these flares, and so they turn on and off. You know, so variability is one way of doing that. Unlike extragalactic sources at these low frequencies, and remember we're talking about FM frequency bands, so like what you turn your radio on in your car to listen to some DJ. It sounds super old then.
Yeah, yes.
Some DJ.
Those kids,
listen
know.
To music. Yeah. Anyway, so you expect variability not from AGN, but you do from these stars.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final one, which is a little bit more complicated, is polarization. So the way the light is emitted from the emission characteristics from stars tend to be what's called circularly polarized. And so I know listeners are probably familiar with polarized glasses, you know, so you have reflection from surfaces. That just means the light is kind of preferentially emitted in a certain direction. So we just kind of look for what's called circular polarization, which is unique to stars generally, very especially high polarization fraction, circularly polarized.
Awesome. So have you found anything interesting?
So we've got our first detection, which is exciting.
That's
so
cool.
This is an oddball. So there's only been one other detection at these low frequencies of a star, and this is a well-known star called UV SETI. This is a group coming out of Sydney and Perth, and in Australia, obviously. This one's an oddball. It's kind of throwing our ideas out the door about how emissions really emerge from these stars. Now, so most stars we've seen in the radio are really basic, normal. And what I would, the astronomers speak, non-degenerate, i.e. they're not neutron stars, they're not white dwarfs, mm-hmm. they're just stars like our yep. sun, right? They're just burning hydrogen to helium in the core. The majority of these emissions come from very magnetically active stars, so they tend to be rapidly rotating, as opposed to our sun that rotates quite slowly over, what's the period of rotation of the sun again?
I don't know, but the sun doesn't really do that much. We still have flares and things, of course, like people have probably heard about solar flares and making the aurora and things like that, but they're not crazy powerful, are they?
They're not from the sun, relatively.
Yeah.
And so these things are quite powerful, and so they're rapidly rotating. So I mean, like, they rotate on day scale, and they're very X-ray bright, even quiescently, so outside of a flare, they're quite easy to see in the X-rays.
Mm-hmm.
And so this star and the flares that come from these things, while they definitely have a distribution, they tend to be short. You know, like a flare from a star like this tend to last 20 minutes or maybe even an hour, but they're quite rare to go longer than that. There's been a few exceptions, but it's reasonably rare. So the star we found is an oddball in all these characteristics. Okay, it's an M-type star, but it's a very slow rotator. It rotates at least 130-day period, you know, so... Whoa, that's odd, you know, when a classic one, I'll just throw a name out there called AD Leo, rotates on like a 2-day timescale, you know, so we're talking about 130 compared to 2. And it's also not seen in the X-rays, even though it's been observed with some of the X-ray telescopes, it's not detected. So it's at least two orders of magnitude fainter in X-rays than AD Leo or UV SETI, these other well-known radio-emitting stars. So how do we make sense of this? So the emission is also weird. The emission we get from this star goes for 8 hours, you know, pretty much on, you know, the whole time. It doesn't show like a sharp drop. We can see it go for 8 hours, and it's what we call broadband. Often a lot of these flares show very sharp frequency structure, you know. So, for example, it'll just drop off after, say, I don't know, let's say 200 megahertz, and it's not seen anymore. This just is on for the whole band of LOFAR.
So it lasts for the flare itself lasts for way longer, like a few times longer than we ever expected to
see. Well, not commonly expected,
yeah.
So the question then becomes, is this a rare event or is this emission from other body? Mm-hmm. This is totally preliminary work, and so we're still trying to understand what's going on.
And I guess most of the mechanisms that we know about, we'd expect it to be the shorter flares that we see now, the dynamo models and things like that of stars, this rotation that you talked about.
Yes. So, yeah, that's the difficult part of it, actually. And the question then becomes, if we just got lucky here with the type of star? Because, like, before this time, no one ever went this deep in all-sky field of view, you know? And so these things are reasonably rare to see a flare from this type of star. You know, if I wrote to very large array, like a very famous radio telescope in America, let's say 10 years ago, and I said, I want to stare at this random M dwarf that's not known to rapidly rotate, and it has no shown characteristics, and I want to look at it for 12 hours or more, you know, I want to occupy this Premier Institute for a long time, that the TAC would probably go, no way,
yeah,
Jose,
you
know, like, well, you're not going to waste our time like that.
Yeah.
And so maybe our selection criteria, all the previous radio searches are being heavily biased.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe this happens all the time. You know, maybe there is a giant flare from an M-Star that lasts 8 hours, you know, and we just have a bad selection window with this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we really need to understand that. And that's what I've been working on for a moment. And this got me excited. So I've been initiating a population study more along these lines with, obviously, Tim Chimwell and Harish from Astron.
Nice. That sounds really cool. And you're looking for more of these kind of objects and that sort of
thing? Yeah, more of these kind of objects and all that kind of fun stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. The holy grail in this field, obviously, is that the emission isn't coming from the star at all. It's actually coming from a companion. So we see this often in the solar system, you know. So you have a Jupiter and you have a moon right near it called Io, and you have this kind of interaction that causes emission quite bright at low frequencies. From material from Io passing through the magnetic field of Jupiter, and you get this aurora that actually comes that's quite bright in the radio, just like aurora you see in the northern and southern hemisphere. I think we say aurora really badly with our accent, by the way.
Aurora, yeah.
Aurora, you know, yeah, going, wow.
How else do you say?
I don't know, but I feel like other people say it so much nicer.
Yeah, that's true.
I feel
true.
Like we have very harsh R's and A's.
It's like, true. Aurora. It just sort of merges all into one swoosh. True. We apologize for that. We can't help our accents.
Yeah, that's right.
And we actually think they're pretty great. Yeah.
That's grating on your ears, Aurora.
We think our accents are pretty great. So, I mean, we're not going to change it.
Anyway.
So yeah. So you're thinking that maybe, like, just as an idea, it could be coming from some sort of linked system between two objects rather than just the star itself.
Yeah, that's possible one explanation. But we still have a lot more work to do. And I understand that. But that would be exciting.
That sounds really cool. We're excited to see more about that then.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
All right, awesome. We might have to wrap up there,
yes.
Joe. So thanks for that. That sounds really cool. We'll keep an eye out for that Nature Astronomy paper and the press release articles.
Yeah.
We'll hopefully be able to include some links on the Jodcast website for that so that you all can have a bit of a read and keep an eye out for Flare Star stuff from Joe as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Laura, and I really appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks for being here, Joe.
All right, bye-bye.
See ya.